Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. This is Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment.
Okay.
All right. Here we go. First show of the first weekend of Pride Month here as we celebrate on the award-winning For the People every year. And we like to bring in new and very unique special friends to talk about things that are going on with them in their world of LGBTQ plus community members, friends. And in the case of our first guest this weekend, it's their LGBTQ plus constituents and all the rest in the jurisdiction of the 143rd Connecticut Assembly District, which is cared for in the State House by my guest, Representative Dominique Johnson. She serves Norwalk and Westport, home to a couple of our radio stations here on the award-winning For the People Syndicate. Dominique is a member of the Education, Higher Education, and Employment Advancement, as well as Judiciary Committee. She just wrapped up a marathon short session, and here we are to talk about things related to the work she does and the life she lives. Dominique, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much, John. I appreciate that introduction and joining you and the listeners here to talk about some great things today.
Yeah, crazy busy times for you now, as I'm learning, talking to you a few times before we recorded. All of the hard work that you and your colleagues have done are now coming to fruition in a number of bill signings as the legislation that was approved all becomes codified. And one of the things that you worked really hard on, along with a number of other of acquaintances of mine in the State House, were bills related to our aging population. And I know among the folks that are kind of commanding your attention is the growing aging population of folks in the LGBTQ plus community.
Well, it's interesting, John, because as you mentioned with my committee, none of those committees focus are the aging committee, but we do see issues with aging pop up once in a while in judiciary, of course, including the nursing home bill that the governor promoted that fortunately passed. I was really lucky in my role as deputy majority caucus chair to be tapped to be part of the team on the House priority bill, which was the really what they're calling sweeping elder care legislation. And I've got to tell you, my district, which I love, is home in Norwalk to, I think, the biggest concentration of elders in Norwalk in terms of neighborhoods. So that was always on my mind about how I can help my neighbors and my constituents, and especially people in my generation who are really turning toward helping our elders. But as an LGBTQ plus person, I'm always thinking about what that means for our community as well, given that we have really unique experiences with aging, like you said, and many times our elders go from a place where they may feel safe to where they don't with these life changes. Mm. So that's something I'm really interested in the future, especially because I think intergenerational connections in our community are so important. And often we don't have the spaces and the connections to really develop those. Yeah. Those families kind of origin are there, but then of choice with our elders are super important.
Yeah, we started this conversation with your colleague Rahib, Representative Rahib, last year, and he was explaining to me how he was so concerned at folks who may have come out in the 60s or the 70s as teens or in their 20 somethings, and now they're in their their golden years, so to speak, and they almost are in some cases having to kind of feel like they need to recloset themselves. It's that's a really disturbing thing.
It is, and he's absolutely right, and it's really wonderful working with him and the few other LGBTQ plus legislators, because I think we see these things in our own community and can really amplify that. It's deeply troubling to think you literally were at the forefront of a civil rights movement, and now you, for your own safety, have to have that part of your dignity of being who you are suppressed. So I think that that's something as we age, especially, I think generally I've learned with working on these bills, folks get sidelined or their lives aren't part of a general conversation. And so I think respecting our elders generally is important, but especially our elders that have unique situations. And we as a community, I think, always could do better in the LGBTQ community doing that for our elders. Because, I mean, we're, like you said, the Stonewall generation is now really becoming 70, 80 years old. And they need us. And they need us to be there for them.
Yeah. You're also kind of in a great district, and I have to say probably the leading district of communities in Connecticut in terms of providing inclusion, support, services, recreation, socialization for LGBTQ plus community members. You've got the Triangle Center down there. You've got a number of great active organizations, including Westport Pride, as we broadcast here on Sunday morning. We're hours away from their main event down in Westport. This is a great community that you are tied to.
I cannot agree more. I love it. It's home in multiple ways, and one of them are these vibrant groups that, you know, literally in the case of Triangle Community Center started decades ago in church basements. And I've been lucky to meet some of those folks that started it. But now, all these years later, we have a vibrant, one of the biggest pride festivals in Norwalk in the entire state. People come from Massachusetts and Rhode Island to come to it, right there on the Sound at Veterans Park coming up June 8th. And as you said, today being Westport Pride, and this is really a testament to that community-minded group to create, you know, this ongoing celebration every year. And every year just seems to keep getting bigger and better and more inclusive. So that's fabulous. They put in, we both have rainbow crosswalks that are year-round in our towns. And I think for a lot of young people, when they see that going by in the family car, that means a lot to something to them to have that recognition that that's something. Really, yeah. Truly, that the cities are doing.
Yeah. You also got me thinking, Dominique, that after meeting with and talking with and getting really fired up, as you probably have from Anthony, and I just had the great pleasure of working with and interviewing Rachel Lenda at the tourism office, and the governor, of course, himself, all talking about, you know, this new branding that Connecticut is doing, Make It Here, and how we're trying to use all means possible to attract more people back to come live in Connecticut, or to whether they've left and we want them to return, or people who have never yet discovered Connecticut. And in listening to you, I'm thinking about all of the places in our country that are so much less friendly to the LGBTQ plus community members and others, and how Connecticut is really kind of an oasis for individuals in those communities, and how welcoming we are to them, and for you to be one of the state house leaders in that respect must give you great pride, if you'll excuse the pun.
It's the perfect word. I feel great pride in being a person who loves our state and not only sees all the things that we're doing that are really coming together, but also the potential yet of what we could build together. You know, make no mistake, LGBTQ plus youth in our state still face, and I know we spoke of this earlier, severe bullying, harassment, victimization, suicidality, and we need to continually address that as part of a bigger mental health crisis among our young people. But in particular, there is work to be done. There are things to do. But when it comes to where we are as a state, especially relative to other states, states that I've even lived in, a variety of different types of, you know, climates. And I can tell you that not only is Connecticut home, but the fact that we are seen as part of the fabric of the identity of the state, of the civic life of the state, I think is very important. So, of course, in the first place, voting. But then second of all the businesses our community starts, the business we bring to certain, like with our festivals in June, but frankly, you know, the fact that this is a place that people come from all over the country to be a tourist because they can be safe, that does speak to our potential if we are and remain, like our motto says, that you can sustain a life here if you come here and contribute. I think that's really important.
Yeah. So let me ask you hypothetically, and I don't know how you are with these kind of questions, but in a quiet moment, you're in a room alone with the governor or with Speaker Ritter, and they say, Representative Johnson, if I was going to put forth the speaker's bill or a governor's bill that would specifically address your greatest concerns about the young members of the LGBTQ plus communities here in Connecticut, what is it I'm going to need to do to try to start making things better?
That is a question that I would deeply wrestle with because of the fact that I've worked in this area as a, you know, my former life, I produced research about school climate and specifically the experiences of young people who are victimized on many of the and bullied in many of the ways that our community experiences. So when I'm in that room, and I've actually said this too, to folks who are in leadership positions, that we need to listen to the youth. So my first step would be to help facilitate a way that the young people can bring their lived experiences to the policymakers. I don't ever want to be in a position where I think I'm doing something that will help a group without actually speaking with them, whether it's elder care or young people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, they have an agenda that I think might seem ambitious to us as adults, but I think we need to listen and really think about how we can bring that, you know, to fruition. There are groups like Equality Connecticut who are trying to do this work right now. And I think that's where we are, is an exciting moment. It was a new organization trying to take what can be an incredibly diverse community and distill some priorities that will help the greatest number. This, to me, focusing on youth should be paramount. And so the youth themselves should be at the table, whether it's a task force or it's kind of a group like the LGBTQ Opportunity Network that amplifies their voices. We need to listen to the youth. So I imagine safe school climate policies are going to be very important with that. And I imagine the ability for young people to feel safe in the school and have a way to express themselves that is not seen as detrimental kind of to the overall school culture is really important. We do have a variety of different types of climates and cultures all across the state. So how we can help individual school communities best amplify and support their students and their potential is going to be important, but it's always got to come from the youth, always. Mm-hmm.
So in lieu of handing you that magic legislative wand, I maybe the next best thing is for me to just ask you to share a little bit about your life experience and speak directly to the youth and the loved ones of those youths in those communities, in order for, if nothing more than to give them, you know, a little bit more faith that there are people like them in positions like yours and that are working hard on their behalf.
Well, that's an amazing opportunity to have, and so I appreciate you for that very much. The first thing I'm thinking about is back to the fact that, you know, I have now almost been out for 30 years, right? I came out in a very different culture and climate and time in our country's history. Like many in my generation, we did not have visibility. So I think it's really important for me to remain visible. And frankly, my message to young people is we're ready for you. And we, our generation, are doing these things so you can go even further. This seat will, it's the people's seat and you're the people. So, you know, consider things that you didn't think were possible. That's fundamentally what I get to do every day, is do something I didn't think was possible when I was their age. So that's fabulous. But the other part of it too is I really admire the progress we've made as a community. But I think that now more than ever, things can be scary. And so my message to families is that, like, to support and uplift one another, we have to find ourselves in community, because that's the way I was able to do what I do now, is I always had somebody in our community looking out for me of an older generation. right? So again, I think finding mentors and elders is very important to this work, to kind of understand how we're on a trajectory. And this trajectory keeps bending because we do the work of community and we do the work of making sure people's voices are heard. And I fundamentally know that things can be scary. And I personally have seen that our young people are coming out into a world that's more accepting generally than when I was their age. But with that, it can be even scarier, because when it's not as accepting as you had hoped, or people still say things that aren't just beyond the pale, but are inflammatory about who you are and meant to hurt you, it probably feels even scarier than I can imagine, because it's, you know, there's this assumption you're going to be a little bit safer. So I think that's what we have to remember, is that while we're doing better, it still is a really scary thing to be who you are sometimes, depending on the context. And that's always something we can work toward, that this is a long-term project and they're part of a lineage and a history that's really working every day, and that they're living the future now. And so again, like, that's why I think it's so important for me to know that they are loved and we're here for you.
With such a lack of education on some individuals' parts and in some cultures, and given the fact that, there's still a lot of stigmatizing against individuals of the LGBTQ plus community. If somebody had 30 seconds to react to their child or the child they are caring for, who comes to them in another quiet moment and comes out, how would you counsel someone who may not really understand it, or even, even who it angers or frustrates? What's the best way to receive that information, in your opinion?
Well, I think, and I think back to what many people in my generation had hoped to hear, but weren't lucky enough in that regard to hear. And I think that this has happened for many generations. I know it still happens today, but the fact of the matter is, if you care about a young person, reminding them that you love them is full stop, is perhaps the most powerful thing, that unconditional love. And if you're not quite ready to add on just the way you are or just the way you were made, at the end of that sentence, doing the work to get there is going to be your journey. But I think a lot of times, remembering that this is about that young person's journey and how important it was that they trusted you to share this with them. And so to maintain that trust and to just understand how special it is that you were trusted is an honor, but also a responsibility. I think to learn more, like you said, and to make sure that even if, to be open to the fact that things you might say aren't received as intended, but the fact that they were received that way, that's important to kind of, as part of the journey, to learn how to best support that young person. But love among all. I think we don't, unfortunately, hear that word enough these days generally, but I think that in that context is really important. Mm-hmm.
Dominique Johnson is a state representative here in Connecticut. She represents the 143rd District, Norwalk and Westport. Big day today in Westport. Go Westport Pride. And Dominique, we'll let you go. We know you're quite busy today. Thank you so much for all the time. Well, as we hit the midpoint here, we've got a number of guests to welcome to the program. From the Epilepsy Foundation of Connecticut, I'm pleased to chat again with Elizabeth Stiblo, who I met a couple of weeks ago at one of their walks. And Monica Anzalone is also with us from the foundation. At that walk, I also had the pleasure of meeting Ann Newman, and she, among other things, is the patient advocacy and engagement lead for an organization here in New Haven called Biohaven, and they are working on a study that we're going to tell folks about. If you know someone or are someone who is living with epilepsy, this may be a option for you. So, so pleased to have you both, all three of you, I should say. So let's start with our friends from the foundation. Elizabeth, before we get into the questions, tell us your epilepsy story and what drove you to come to work at the foundation.
Yeah, so I don't have epilepsy myself, but I, since I started working at the foundation, I've met so many people who live with it. And I found that it's a really resilient and caring community. Everyone really wants to help each other out. And it's been a great learning experience. I didn't realize how common epilepsy is, but actually 1 in 26 people live with epilepsy, which is a very high statistic. And I had no idea how common it is. I think part of that is because people have this idea that seizures are only what you see in movies and TV, whereas people falling to the ground and collapsing. But a lot of seizures, you can't actually, it's really hard to tell when people are having them. Sometimes it just appears as people zoning out or daydreaming, but they're actually having seizures with extra electricity happening in their brain and causing them to have seizures without it being super noticeable. So a big thing that we want to do at the foundation is raise awareness about how seizures present and how differently they can present, and just let people know that there's a lot more people living with epilepsy out there than you may realize.
Okay. How about you, Monica? What brought you to the foundation?
So I have a work background in the social service field, and I've been here for about 8 years now and was looking for a change at the time, and this really provided a great opportunity to sort of branch out into the field, continuing to work with people but sort of in a different way. And I've also been able to, providing education has been sort of a new addition to my expertise, I guess you could say, since I started working here. And when I did start working here, I didn't realize that at the time I knew probably at least 3 individuals in my life that had a particular seizure disorder. So it really is kind of interesting, as Elizabeth mentioned, until you really sort of stop and consider, your connection to something like this, you don't realize how common it is, but it really is. And in Connecticut alone, we have over 36,000 individuals that have a diagnosis of epilepsy.
So from a little bit more of a science lesson standpoint, how do you explain to people what epilepsy is and how it works in the mechanics of the human body?
Yeah, well, as Elizabeth mentioned, 1 in 26 will be diagnosed with epilepsy in their lifetime. And this is actually one of the most common neurological conditions, which is usually characterized by reoccurring and unprovoked seizure events. And doctors are able to provide that diagnosis by offering a series of tests to be able to determine that this is what's happening. And really, this is an excessive electrical discharge that's occurring in the brain between the neurons in our brain, which we have billions of. And usually those neurons function in the right way, so that we're able to, do the things that, we need to do each day. Mm. But in the brain of somebody that is having a seizure, those neurons basically are misfiring, and that is what is causing or creating those seizure symptoms that people are experiencing. And there are over 30 different types of seizures, and they really do vary from person to person, although they can be and tend to be pretty predictable for each person. Once they are diagnosed, a diagnosis of epilepsy, it can be pretty obvious for doctors, and then it can also be very unobvious for doctors. And so it can take a lot longer for some to be properly diagnosed. It really does depend on the individual. Epilepsy is a spectrum disorder, and so it really is sort of very different. Again, everyone's experience is going to be quite unique, and they're going to fall on all different sides of that spectrum. Hmm.
So what's the latest, greatest scientific or medical development or developments that are, helping the most people today?
Well, So I guess medications are always the first go-to for doctors. So mm-hmm. once someone receives this diagnosis, they will consider medication. If the medication is not working and they've tried, you know, beyond three different, you know, sort of what they call medication trials, mm-hmm. and it's still not working to control the seizures, there are other options today, including what we call brain stimulation. And so there are a few different devices that have been created and developed to sort of control that irregular electrical activity that's occurring in the brain. So there are those stimulation devices, and then there's also actual brain surgery as well, mm-hmm. which doctors are really, I think, kind of pushing more for patients that are eligible. Yeah. Sometimes patients are not eligible for brain surgery, depending on where that activity is occurring in the brain. But surgery is also an option. Dietary therapies are also something that can be prescribed, usually are more so prescribed for younger kids. Mm-hmm. But people have more options today, I feel like, than what they did even 10 years ago.
Well, that's good. So one of the things that is probably still sadly certain is that, especially for younger people, who are living with epilepsy, you know, children, adolescents, and teens, this condition can be somewhat stigmatizing, I'm sorry to say. And one of the great things I learned about from Elizabeth when I attended the recent walk was that you guys provide a safe and welcoming, judgment-free, and super fun opportunity for a lot of young people in the summer at something called Camp Courage. Elizabeth, why don't you tell us about that and who can attend?
Yeah, so Camp Courage is a week-long overnight camp, and it's for youth living with epilepsy specifically. So this year it's going to be from July 14th to July 19th, and it's going to be at Camp Horizons in South Windham. And what's really unique about this camp is it provides a very safe environment for children living with epilepsy. A licensed nurse is always in residence, and all the camp counselors are trained in seizure recognition and first aid.
So tell the folks a little bit about what the campers get to do at Camp Courage.
Yeah, so they get to do all the normal camp activities that include swimming and fishing and arts and crafts. They get to have campfires, and they do a lot more. They play music and get to experiment with different musical instruments. They have dance parties and movie nights. So it's a lot of the fun, typical camp activities that any other camper would get to participate in.
And this camp is unique because I imagine obviously all of the campers are living with epilepsy, but are some of the counselors and staff also, they bring that empathy factor with them?
Yeah, so all the counselors are really great with the kids. They do a really good job preparing the counselors ahead of time to know what to deal with and what to expect. And so it becomes a very supportive and welcoming environment for all the campers to attend. And what's really, really great about the camp is that these kids are getting to interact with kids who share similar experiences to them. And that creates some really wonderful friendships between them in a really safe and fun environment. And it also gives kids a chance to really build up their self-esteem. For a lot of kids living with epilepsy, they don't have a lot of chances to be independent. They always have someone, like an adult, with them to make sure that if they have a seizure, they'll be cared for. So this camp provides kids this opportunity to really build their self-confidence and have a chance to really be independent a lot of times for the first time. So it's really, really an exciting time.
Fantastic. So we will remind folks at the end of the broadcast how to learn more and get registered. But let's also tell them now, Elizabeth, what's the best way for people to learn more and perhaps sign up a young person that they know?
Yeah. So the camp is open to children, teens, and young adults ages 8 to 25 living with epilepsy. And people that are interested in learning more about the camp can visit our website, epilepsyct.com. Again, that's epilepsyct.com. And they can go to our camp page and see all the information about the camp, people to contact if you have questions, and then you can also have access to our application.
Fantastic. We're going to give Elizabeth and Monica a little bit of a break, and we're going to meet Ann Newman in just a moment. But, well, summer's right around the corner, and Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo has tons of fun activities lined up for guests of all ages, like their annual photography contest that deadlines on July 4th, a great opportunity for photographers of all ages to showcase their great work. The zoo is also excited to bring back Sky Hunters in Flight this summer. Beginning June 15th, guests can watch impressive birds of prey like owls, hawks, and falcons fly above and demonstrate their natural abilities. This educational and entertaining show is a family favorite you won't want to miss, along with dozens and dozens of others. This is just a tip of the offerings in the coming weeks, so if you want to get the entire huge program of Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo activities, all you need to do is go to beardsleyzoo.org. So as we said at the introduction, we're talking about epilepsy today and possible ways to support and help folks with epilepsy. We're pleased to have Elizabeth Stiblo and Monica Anzalone with us from the Epilepsy Foundation of Connecticut. If you'd like to learn more about that organization, you can go to epilepsyct.com. But as I was saying earlier, I also had the pleasure of meeting someone else who's bringing a collateral piece of education to us today. Ann Newman is the, among other things, the patient advocacy and engagement lead for Biohaven. So, Ann, let's start with what is Biohaven? You explained it to me in person. But for the folks listening, tell us about it.
Sure. Thanks so much, John. Mm-hmm. Biohaven, as you mentioned, we're a pharmaceutical company headquartered in New Haven. We have many investigational medications in our pipeline in various stages of development. Our goal here at Biohaven really is to change the lives of people with unmet medical needs. Biohaven continues to advance clinical programs that include late and early stage products. We're committed to discovering, developing, and commercializing life-changing new therapies for people with debilitating diseases.
Very good. You're recruiting now for epilepsy studies. Let's hear a little bit about those.
Yes. So we currently are recruiting for epilepsy studies. We're looking for people living with epilepsy between the ages of 18 and 65 years old that have focal seizures and are not well controlled on their current medications. Focal seizures are also sometimes called partial or complex partial seizures. Our second study we're also recruiting for is in generalized seizures, also known as idiopathic generalized epilepsy, which are really your more stereotypical or more recognizable tonic-clonic type seizures. This study is also looking for people who are not well controlled on their current medication regimen.
Mm-hmm. And so let me break from the bullet points here just to ask, are you accepting direct interest referrals from individuals who know they're diagnosed with one of these two types of seizure situations under the epilepsy diagnosis? Or are you also getting referrals from the physicians who are treating them and are maybe equally frustrated because they're not getting the success that they want?
Sure. You know, as a patient advocate, I always recommend, and as a mother of a daughter living with epilepsy, I always recommend that patients advocate for themselves. So there are a couple of ways that you can get information on the clinical studies. You can do that on clinicaltrials.gov and look up epilepsy studies. You can also reach ours by going to biohavenpharma.com and look under our clinical trials tab, and you'll find a list of the different clinical trials going on, and particularly our epilepsy studies.
So for these latest two epilepsy studies that you're now recruiting for, where would people have to go? Where are the sites of the the centers or the locations where people have to go to engage in these studies?
So these are global studies. However, here in the U.S., we are spread over 60 sites, and those can be either in private hospitals, clinics, or in academic institutions that cover many of the U.S. states. You can, again, find that information out on the websites that I mentioned previously, or by asking your current physician.
For those who like to do their own thorough due diligence first, can you talk a little bit about the investigational drug you're researching?
Sure. So we are researching an investigational medication, which is called a potassium channel activator. This is a new type of medication in the treatment of epilepsy. And what it is intended to do is to treat epilepsy with minimal side effects. As we know, most of the current treatments on the market have several side effects, and our goal here is really to investigate this medication in hopes to reduce seizure activity while reducing side effects.
Very good. What would someone experience over the course, or what would they expect to experience if they ended up being accepted into one of these studies, or why would they want to participate in the first place?
Sure. So if patients or people living with epilepsy continue to have seizures on their current treatment and have tried other treatments in the past, participating in a clinical trial could potentially help. However, not everyone who is participating in a clinical trial gets active drug. So in our trials, it's on a 2-to-1. So for every 2 patients that would get active drug, one would get a placebo. And a placebo is a medication that does not have active drug in it.
Okay. How could you say how long they could expect to be engaged, or is it just a one-time experience?
So both of the trials have a little bit of a different length.
Mm-hmm.
So really only from about 8 to 12 weeks for the screening period, and generally about 5 months the clinical trial will run.
Okay. Very good. And once again, remind folks how they're going to reach you to get more information or possibly be considered as candidates.
Sure. So you can reach us at biohavenclinicaltrials.com and go under our clinical trials for epilepsy, or you can just generally go to clinicaltrials.gov or biohavenpharma.com.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Ann Newman with Biohaven. And she is in part the patient advocacy and engagement lead for that organization. We hope this information is helpful for folks who are looking for possible other ways of treating epilepsy, if you qualify. Let's go back to our friends Elizabeth Stylo and Monica Anzalone from the Epilepsy Foundation of Connecticut to take us to the end of the program this morning. Guys, you talked a lot about Camp Courage before, and you are currently taking applications for that. Just quickly, Elizabeth, talk us through the qualifying criteria, how old they have to be, and where they need to go to sign up or learn more.
Yeah, so any children, teens, and young adults ages 8 to 25 living with epilepsy are eligible to participate in Camp Courage. And to learn more about the program, find our application, and find contacts if you have any questions, you can visit our website, epilepsyct.com. Again, that's epilepsyct.com, and then just go to the Camp Courage page.
Great. And you, if folks want to support the Epilepsy Foundation of Connecticut, and they like to swing the golf clubs, you've got a tournament coming up. Tell us about that.
Yes. We have our TF for Epilepsy Golf Benefit coming up on Friday, July 19th. This is a really important fundraising event that we do. It's going to be held at Lyman Orchards. They have a really beautiful 18-hole course that we're going to use, and it's going to be such a fun day. We're going to have a lot of golf contests, including the long drive, the close to the pin, and the hole-in-one. And actually, our prize for the hole-in-one this year is a brand-new car, so that's pretty exciting. We're also going to have, after the golf playing is all done, we're going to have a little reception, and it's going to include a teacup raffle with some really fun prizes and a 50-50 raffle. We're also going to have a tasting from Litchfield Distillery, so it's going to be a really fun day, and you'll be supporting a really great cause. It costs $180 per person to register, but that price includes your green fees, a car, a golfer gift, a light breakfast, a lunch, and a dinner. And since it's at Lyman's Orchards, you also get sent home with a free pie. So it's a really good deal, and it's going to be a pie. Yeah.
You should have just said pie first, and I would have just put you on pause and went and registered. Very good.
Yeah, and excellent. They're so good. They're so tasty. I take one every year.
So they could just go to the website?
Just go to our website, epilepsyct.com, and you'll find all the information about the event.
And not just that, but also great educational information and referrals. You can learn about seizure response dogs, safety devices, prescription assistance, and transportation. It's all available for you at epilepsyct.com. You go there to learn about and register for Camp Courage or the golf tournament. And you go to our friend Ann Newman at Biohaven if you'd like to find out about one of the two epilepsy studies that we talked about earlier in the program. I want to thank everybody for the time and education this morning. Best of luck with the summer activities, the camp, and the golf tournament. And Ann, best of luck with the recruitments on the studies. We'd love to hear if anybody came to you because they heard you on the radio. So just stay in touch, both all of you. And thank you for being on the program today. Well, regular listeners will often hear the fleeting announcement about Read to Grow on our program, but now it's time to expand on that. We're so pleased to be able to have with us this morning the executive director of Read to Grow, Susanna Holzenbeck, is with us, and we will talk a lot about what's going on with Read to Grow, especially some fantastic new news about their newborn literacy project. We will be with you in just a moment, right after these words. Connecticut-based AmeriCares wants you to know that more than one-third of the world's population lacks adequate access to medicines. You can help. They deliver donated medicine to a trusted network of local partners around the world. And every $1 you give can provide $20 in aid to people affected by poverty or disaster around the world and here in the United States. Your gift today can make a life-saving impact to millions around the world. If you want to be part of the solution or learn more, just visit AmeriCares.org. Back, and thank you, Susanna Holzenbeck. Great to have you. Thank you for joining us. We've been, you know, probably every 2 or 3 weeks we're getting some email or outreach from Read to Grow. You guys yourselves have grown as an organization tremendously over the past decade or so. Tell us a little bit about yourself, how you came to the organization, and what you guys do.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's really an honor to be able to talk about Read to Grow and this good work that we do. I joined the organization in January of 2020, so 2 months before the world changed for everybody, and have had the privilege and the honor of leading the organization through the last several years, through COVID, and now into a post-COVID time. And, you know, Read to Grow actually started 24 years ago. In 2025, we'll celebrate 25 years of Read to Grow in Connecticut. And Read to Grow started with a group of really committed women who learned the troubling statistic that not all children have books of their own at home. And they said, how can we change this? How can we change this? And they decided to start in the hospital and give every baby born their first book. And so they literally walked around the maternity floor at Yale New Haven Hospital and giving out copies of books to new parents. And that was, you know, 24 years ago. And now we are in 15 hospitals. As of last week, we just added our 15th hospital partner, Hospital of Central Connecticut in New Britain. So every baby born in those 15 hospitals gets our Welcome to the World book. It's a board book. And I actually got the book twice when I had my two children. I have young children. They're 6 and 8. So pretty recently, I had the experience even before I started working at Read to Grow. Wow. I was in the hospital, got the visit from the volunteer at the time. You know, pre-COVID, there were many volunteers from Read to Grow who go and meet with families. And got the books. And for my first son, the Welcome to the World book was one of his favorite books when he was two. He requested it every night. And for families who do this reading, you know, you sit down, your child gets to choose the book, and there's a lot of the same books that they pick over and over and over again.
Sure.
And Welcome to the World was one of his books, and it's well-loved. It's, you know, if I showed you my copy, you'd see the teeth marks from, you know, cutting their teeth. And this was before I even started working here. So I have that personal experience of really knowing what it's like to receive the love and the care of someone saying, hey, you know, here's a gift for you and your family to really share this joy of reading. Even when your baby is a newborn.
Yeah, I bet you talk to a lot of people now that you're with Read to Grow who have a shared experience in that the book that they got from Read to Grow in the maternity ward hours or days after the birth of their children kind of become keepsakes.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes, we have families that share with us, you know, 5, 10, 15 years later, we actually just had a family, a teenager, who 15 years ago got our book at one of the hospitals in Connecticut, and she decided to do a book drive for us. And that's how she found out about us, you know, was when she was a newborn, her family got the book, and they stayed in touch with all that we do, and they ran a book drive for us. So they visited our warehouse last week, and you know, the mom still has, at that time, I think it was Baby's Day, which was a book that we used to distribute to newborns by Nancy Wallace. And she still has that book. And we hear that from lots of families, that they keep those books for their children for, you know, as you said, as keepsakes.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, the effort to promote literacy by giving a book in the delivery room to every child at all the hospital partnerships that you guys have developed over the years is great, but sustaining literacy, that's the heavy lift. How do you guys try to maintain engagement with families that you impress and meet in the delivery room to ensure or to at least support the hope that that child will go on to read many hundreds or thousands of books after the first one they got from Read to Grow?
I love this question so much because it really does acknowledge that it's a sustained effort. It's not just a one-time interaction that will, you know, make the big difference. It's the one-time interaction that may inspire someone, but then you have to keep going with resources and information. And so what Read to Grow does is we recognize, you know, first of all, getting the book in the hospital, some people realize that they've gotten a book, and many people don't even realize that they've gotten this resource. And so we make sure that we are messaging families in a variety of ways. So about 8 years ago, we actually launched our prenatal project, and that is in partnership with community health clinics around the state. So the prenatal literacy project actually starts even before baby is born. And so with our healthcare partners, we create the materials and gather the books and train the healthcare providers, our partners, and then they deliver the books and the information to the families that they are serving. So when a pregnant mom goes in to for her wellness checkup, she also gets a book from Read to Grow and the messaging about you can actually read to your belly even before baby comes sure. into this world.
Mm-hmm.
Start reading to your belly, establishing that routine. If you already have children in the home, you know, having them read to your belly, join you for story time, other adults sharing books with so they can start to, you know, in utero, babies can start hearing at 23 weeks, and so they can hear you, you know, sharing your voice. And so that's two touch points potentially for a family as they're gearing up to have baby. And then they go on and have the baby in the hospital. They get our book, our Welcome to the World book, and then they have an opportunity to sign up to get more books from us at 3 months and a year in their baby's first year of life. And we mail those home to them. And right now they have an option of choosing books in English or books that are bilingual in Spanish and English. You know, we recognize that there are families that speak many other languages in Connecticut, but for now that those are the languages we provide. And so families who sign up for that, again, it's at no cost to families. and it doesn't matter where you live in Connecticut, what zip code you're from, what your income is, this is a program for everybody. We want all children to have books. And so we'll mail the book and we'll mail more information to families about, you know, developmentally, where is your baby right now? What sorts of things are appropriate to do with your child around literacy? You know, letting them chew on the book, letting them flip through the pages, even if the book's upside down, it's, you know, becoming familiar with books. Having that sort of joyful interaction with books is so critical to, you know, developing a love of story time and books as the child grows older. Yeah. And so I'll give you one statistic. You had asked about, you know, how does this impact families? Mm. And what we find is if a family enrolls in the first year program and gets those the books at 3 months and a year, they have the option to fill out a survey. You know, they can fill out the survey or not. We'll still send them the books. But if they do fill out the survey, we collect that information. And one of the questions we ask is, how often are you reading to your infant? And there's a report called the State of Babies Report put out by 0-3. And for Connecticut, you know, the statewide average is about 48% of families report reading daily to their young children. Read to Grow families, it's around 74% of families report reading daily. So exciting to know that, you know, simple interventions like this really can make a difference.
Yeah. And honestly, Susanna, statistics like that are what inspire passionate volunteerism and partnerships, and both of those, without both of those, Read to Grow wouldn't be able to do what it does. Before we get into to talking about the big news, this brand new newborn literacy project, let's talk a little bit about the volunteers that come to Read to Grow, including folks who gave you your first two Read to Grow books after your children were born, and the partnerships that are vital to the sustainability of the organization.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So Read to Grow is really lucky. We have a deep cohort of really committed volunteers who show up regularly here at our warehouse, in our office space, to help us create all of those literacy packets that go out. You know, we get out more than 120,000 books a year and about 35,000 literacy packets a year through the Just the Books for Babies program. And so we need help putting those packets together. And so we have a fabulous group of committed volunteers who show up to put those packets together. And then we also have folks who come to the office to help us with data entry, right? The back end of all of this that makes it work. And then we have folks out in the community. We have ambassadors for Read to Grow who are, you know, in some of the hospitals. Not all of the hospitals allow volunteers to be on the floor.
Yep,
sort of depends on the hospital system.
Sure.
But some hospitals do. And so we have volunteers at those hospitals who go in and briefly meet with families. We know that it's a busy time and there's a lot of interruptions in the hospital, but the volunteer is really there to just make sure they know they've got that book and they can sign up to get more books and to encourage them to share that joy with their newborn. So that's sort of the framework for our volunteers. If folks are interested in volunteering with Read to Grow, they can go onto our website, readtogrow.org, and there is a button, you know, how to help, and volunteering is one of them. But we also need people to, you know, run book drives for us. We get out books for our Books for Kids program, and we need folks, even if you can't come every week, to help us make literacy packets, but you could commit to, you know, running a book drive for us or donating books to us just from your own children's book collection, or connecting with a publisher to get a donation of new children's books to give to us. That is so helpful to us because it's hard for us to keep up with the demand, honestly.
Sure.
So you know, doing those sort of one-off book drives for us are tremendously helpful.
Folks want to learn more about that, they could just go to readtogrow.org to get started and to learn how to get engaged. I don't want to squeeze the time here, but you do have a couple of also, besides the hospitals that that let you in or let you access their maternity candidates and patients. Who are a couple of the other major partners that you deal with who help make the organization so successful?
Yes, absolutely. So we work with over 200 different community organizations across Connecticut. We are statewide, and we have roots in every county across Connecticut in a variety of ways, whether it's the hospital program with the newborns, whether it's our prenatal project with different community health clinics. And then we've got our Books for Kids program. So any agency that's serving young children in Connecticut can request books from us, and we will try our best to get them what they need. And then we've got our bookmobile that goes out. And, you know, we go everywhere with our bookmobile. Wherever there are children that need books, we try to make it out there to stop, and children can get on that bookmobile and get our books. And that looks like partnering with food banks. That looks like partnering with domestic violence organizations serving families in crisis. That looks like going to, preschools and elementary schools in different neighborhoods across the state. It also looks like going to community events. Our bookmobile is heading out to Naugatuck today for a bookmobile stop, despite the rain. We try to find the community partners that are doing the good work in the community and help them to do their work.
Excellent.
In partnership.
So before we let you go, the big news, the Newborn Literacy Project is the latest headlines Read to Grow is making. In a nutshell, Susanna, what is the Newborn Literacy Project?
Yeah, so the Newborn Literacy Project is, that's the project that's in the hospitals with the books going out to newborns. And there are 8 hospitals left in Connecticut that we are working on partnering with. We are currently partnered with 15. We have 8 more to go, and then we will reach every baby born in Connecticut. And so we are, thankfully, we got some state funding in the last budget, and that helped us launch this effort to really reach all newborns across the state. But we need help. We need help to sustain it. It's one thing to launch it. It's a whole other thing to sustain it. I'm actually traveling down to Bridgeport today to a launch of our NICU project. That's where we give books to babies in the NICU.
Yeah.
And we are launching at St. Vincent's Hospital in Bridgeport. And so we are growing and expanding, and we're doing that deliberately. So that we can reach all corners of the state.
All right. Well, if you're somebody who realizes and supports the importance of reading and literacy, Read to Grow would love to have you among its allies. If you'd like to learn more about how to volunteer, how to participate, how to host the book drive or the bookmobile for that matter, or to donate to make sure this organization can keep up with the demand for books. It's wonderful to hear that there is almost more demand for books than there are books available, at least through Read to Grow channels at this point. So that's just a testament to what a great job they do, celebrating 25 years next year. Read to Grow is promoting language skills and literacy for children beginning at birth and to support and supporting parents as their baby's first teachers, just like our guest was twice with Read to Grow. Susanna Holzenbeck is now the executive director of Read to Grow Connecticut. ReadToGrow.org is the website to go to learn about it, to find out about volunteerism, or to support the organization. Susanna, thank you so much for your time this morning. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host, If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA for our program that's relevant to the audiences and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to john.vocat@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program can be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station websites. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs John Vocat. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime. Just find it under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.